You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Protests continued in Turkey today against an invasion into Iraq, with Greenpeace activists bolting themselves to U.S. military convoys at the Mediterranean port of Iskenderun, and students marching in the streets of Ankara. In the southeast of Turkey, near the border with Iraq, police injured 8 protesters and arrested 4 as trade union leaders tried to bring a message of peace to the border. The American military is also active near the border, renting private land from Turkish civilians from the border city of Kiziltepe. Aaron Glantz reports.
The call to prayer at the main mosque in the center of Kiziltepe, one of the small Kurdish towns that dot the landscape near the border between Turkey and northern Iraq. The Turkish parliament may have turned down a resolution giving the Bush administration authority to launch a war on Iraq from Turkish soil, but U.S. military officials are visiting nearly every warehouse and large commercial space in the area, trying to acquire enough land to launch a 60,000-troop invasion. But as elsewhere in Turkey, the war is unpopular here, with more than 90% opposed. The city of Kiziltepe denied the American army the use of its municipal warehouse, even though the Pentagon offered the city 10 times the warehouse's regular price.
We don't want to do anything that will help war. We want to create some hope.
Ömer Demirtaş is vice mayor of Kiziltepe.
We didn't allow it because we didn't want the people's lives to be compared with money. We wanted to tell them, you can't buy the people with your money.
On the outside of town, the municipal warehouse sits half empty. A handful of workers loading empty cartons onto the back of the truck are almost the only activity here. The economy has been in free fall since George Bush Sr. launched his war in Iraq from Turkish soil in 1991, and the situation has been made worse by 13 years of United Nations sanctions on Iraq. For 15 days, the border between Turkey and northern Iraq has been completely closed. The surrounding area turned into a special military zone. Everyone who made their living through trade is unemployed. And while city officials refuse to support the war, many property owners in the area are renting their land to the American Army. Workers put the finishing touches on a used car dealership halfway between Kiziltepe and the neighboring city of Mardin. It's unlikely the building will ever open for business, though. The owner is in the final stages of negotiation with the U.S. military. His property is prime real estate. It's very close to Mardin's airport. The U.S. military hopes to airlift tens of thousands of troops to Mardin to fight the war. Khaled is helping to build the used car lot.
If the war begins, no one will want to buy a car. There are many people selling, but nobody's buying.
Selatin I owns the complex. He says if he thought he could prevent the war by refusing to give his land over to the Americans, he would do so. But every day, new convoys of American military vehicles arrive in the area. War, he says, is imminent.
I am against the war because we don't know what the war will bring. It will bring destruction, and it will also bring more economic crisis to the area. But think about this. Some people say the war wouldn't begin if we wouldn't give this area to the United States. It would be good not to lease it to the army, but unfortunately, whether or not the war begins won't depend on us alone.
And yet, as U.S. troops make their way onto Turkish soil, newly elected Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced he will move slowly towards a second vote in parliament. Erdogan told reporters he wouldn't schedule a vote on allowing large numbers of U.S. troops onto Turkish soil until March 21st. He also sacked his predecessor's foreign minister, Yasser Yakish, the architect of the deal rejected by Parliament allowing the Bush administration to launch its war in Iraq from Turkish soil. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Kiziltepe, southeastern Turkey.
Late yesterday, a federal appeals court judge turned down a suit challenging the president's power to go to war in Iraq without a declaration of war by the Congress of the United States. As hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops arrive in the Gulf region, opponents from within the military are taking steps, both macro and micro, to deter a final massive assault, or at least to not participate in it personally. Melinda Tuhus has more about resistance on two tracks.
On February 13th, a group of active duty soldiers, parents of men and women serving in the military, and 12 members of Congress filed a lawsuit to stop the U.S. from launching a full-scale war on Iraq. The suit is known as Doe versus Bush to protect the identities of those currently on active duty in various branches of the military. Lead attorney John Bonifaz explains the basis of the lawsuit.
Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution makes very clear that Congress and only Congress has the power to declare war. And Congress did not have the authority under the Constitution to transfer that power for making this momentous decision onto the president. Congress can't pass on to the president the power to levy taxes. Congress can't pass on to the president the power to appropriate money. Congress can't pass on to the president the decision of whether or not to send this nation to war. There are certain powers that are non-delegable. And we clearly would not accept if Congress had passed a resolution transferring to the Supreme Court the decision of whether or not to go to war. So why would we somehow accept it if it's transferred to the president?
The suit was dismissed February 24th by a judge in Boston who ruled that the judiciary has no power to intervene in matters of foreign policy, except in cases where Congress and the president are strongly and clearly in conflict. The plaintiffs immediately appealed and were granted an expedited hearing before a three-judge panel on March 4th. Yesterday, the panel upheld the lower court ruling but kept the case alive. The judges told the plaintiffs that if the UN Security Council votes down the U.S. resolution to use force against Iraq, they can immediately go back to court to seek an injunction against President Bush to stop him from going to war without waiting for any bombs to drop. Charlie Richardson is one of the plaintiffs. He and his wife co-founded a group last October called Military Families Speak Out. His son, who is not a plaintiff, is a Marine serving in the Gulf. More than 200 families have joined so far, hoping to stop the rush to war in Iraq.
As military families, we have both a special voice to speak with, but also a special need to speak out on issues of war and peace.
If the appeals court rules in favor of the plaintiffs, it would issue a court order to stop the administration from conducting the war without a congressional declaration of war. Attorney Bonifaz says he has no illusions that a favorable ruling would mean a quick victory.
I don't doubt for a moment that the U.S. Department of Justice, which is representing President Bush and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld in this case, would immediately seek a stay of that order and try to get the Supreme Court to overturn it.
Charlie Richardson says winning the appeal would have a very practical impact.
It would stimulate a great deal of discussion, debate, and democracy in this country. The president has looked at 8 to 10 million people in the streets around the world and called them a focus group. He has said that he doesn't really care about the voice of people in this country and in other countries around the world. We hope that this ruling, a positive ruling here, will drive this discussion back into Congress where people have more of an ability to be in touch with their representatives and have a voice.
Meanwhile, a consortium of military support groups operating as the GI Rights Hotline is fielding thousands of calls from those in uniform who need help. Some callers want to resolve problems so they can function within the military, while others just want to get out. The hotline is staffed by volunteers, both veterans and civilians. It was founded in 1995 and took 1,500 calls that year. Last year, counselors answered 21,000 calls, and in January of this year alone, 3,500 people called in. Bill Galvin is a GI rights trainer from the Center on Conscience and War.
Very few people join the military because they want to be in the military. They join the military because they don't know what they're going to do with their life. They don't know how they're going to pay for college. Nobody's coming into their school offering them a job except the military recruiters. And the recruiters are there a lot. And so they seem to be the only people offering anything. And what they have to offer sounds good. And in particular, people in the reserves, they buy the line of, you know, pick up some extra money for doing something different and unusual one weekend a month. And then people join the National Guard thinking, well, you know, that what they expect they'll be doing is like if there's a flood or a hurricane or something like that, they'll be called up to help people. But they, at that point, they're not thinking about going to war. Most people realize pretty early on they made a mistake They realize that it is all about war and it is something they don't want to be a part of.
Galvin says the easiest commitment to get released from is the Delayed Entry Program, or DEP, in which a recruit enlists but doesn't report for duty for up to a year.
Anybody who is in the DEP who changes their mind does not have to go. It is very easy to get out of the DEP. The hardest part from our perspective is convincing people how easy it is, because they are led to believe that they're going to be in big trouble if they don't go.
Connie Baird's son attended a military college that does not require its graduates to accept a military commission. But when he accepted a scholarship, he was expected to join the reserves and put in 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks each summer. Baird says her son soon realized the military was not for him. He changed schools in the middle of a semester, and Baird says he planned to repay the portion of the scholarship he'd used, but it was not an easy exit.
The commanding officers there actually passed threats to him through his former roommate, saying things like, you know, you better sign up, you signed a contract, you'll be sorry if you don't, and harassed him for several months, and he was really feeling stressed. And through the Quakers, I found out about Bill's organization and told him to go contact him, go see him, and he did, and submitted some paperwork, which, you know, he's in the middle of. We haven't heard a response yet, but they've also stopped calling him and telling him to report for drills, so I think that's a hopeful sign.
Many people apply for discharges due to medical or financial family hardship. Another exit strategy is telling the military you're gay or bisexual, because under the homophobic don't ask, don't tell policy, acknowledging homosexuality is grounds for honorable discharge in most cases. And Galvin says there's yet another avenue.
If you have ethical, moral, or religious beliefs that develop that say that it's wrong for you to participate in war, then that is grounds for discharge. And we actually help a lot of folks that are in that situation.
Because COs must subject to all wars, not just particular ones, the number of GIs who can successfully receive a discharge this way is a small minority. But it's growing, says Galvin.
During the first Gulf War, they suspended all discharges, including CO discharges, and so people were stuck with either going to war or going to jail, and lots of people went to jail. And so far, that has not happened this time around. In fact, it almost seems like they're trying to avoid the confrontation. That could change tomorrow, okay? I mean, although the Pentagon has a policy of discharging COs, it is a Pentagon policy that's based on the draft law, which is still on the books. There is no law requiring the Pentagon to discharge conscientious objectors. So if the Pentagon decided tomorrow to suspend this, that would create the same kind of problems we had in the Gulf War. Now, they may not do that for political reasons, given the opposition to this war. And part of what we're doing is trying to work to get the law changed so that the Pentagon would not be able to just suspend this at will, but get it written into military law.
Galvin notes that women comprise about 15% of the military, but significantly more than 15% of those applying for CO status. Sam Diener is a GI rights hotline counselor from Boston. Based on interviews he's done, he thinks conscientious objectors aren't as isolated in the military as one might think.
What I'm hearing from members of the military is actually a lot of disquiet within the military. There's many people in the military who question this particular war and don't really think it makes much sense. There's certainly people who are gung-ho, and conscientious objectors who I've worked with have said that they've received a few negative comments. But interestingly, they've received a lot of supportive comments as well, and I think much more support, at least in my sense, than in the early 90s, for example.
For information on the lawsuit, Bush versus Doe, contact Military Families Speak Out. Visit their website at www.mfso.org. For help with an individual problem in the military, contact GI Rights Hotline at 800-394-9544. Or visit their website at www.girights.org. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
As the possibility of war with Iraq monopolizes the headlines, it seems everyone has an opinion on the subject. Peace Watch correspondents Kim Green and Hal Humphreys recently traveled around Middle Tennessee, speaking with veterans with diverse opinions.
This guitar, this Gibson J45, is a special guitar. It's not one that I play, I keep, because I took it to Vietnam with me. My name is Robert Longhazard. I don't believe we should go to war with Iraq. I think we should protect ourselves, but I think it's un-American what we're doing. I think it shows an arrogance and a lack of respect for other people in the world, which is exactly the same kind of thing that we took to Vietnam, in my opinion.
Name is Tom Carolyn, and I was a corporal in the Army, also a prisoner of war for 3 years in the Korean War. I've experienced what these people can do, you know, once they get a hold of you or get into your country, and that's the reason I said he needs to be stopped, you know, one way or the other.
My name is Fred Tucker, retired Marine major. Served two tours in Vietnam after a short stint in Dominican Republic back in 65. Those of us who have been in war hope and pray that, you know, we don't have to go to war, but the Bible tells us that there'll always be wars or rumors of war. So I think it's pretty well established that our utopian hope that all this would go away and veterans would become extinct, in reality, I don't think that's going to happen, unfortunately.
My name is William H. Berkeley, Jr., and I went in the service from July the 1st, 1941, till the first day of December, 1945. Went back in the service in November of 46 and stayed until July 29th, 1966, and retired. I'm an old soldier, and I hate war worse than anybody. But I hate people who try to shove something down our throats. And that's one of the things that we've fought so hard for, is to keep the enemy off of our shores. But they made it this time, and we've got to do something about it.
Robert Longhazard. I'm very proud of being in the 1st Infantry Division, and I keep my patch on my dresser all the time. It doesn't take anything to put a bumper sticker on and have two flags on a pickup truck riding around Mount Juliet. Everybody's froggy. When they put you in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, when they put you in hell holes like Fort Polk, Louisiana, and then you're going over there, that changes a lot of feelings, believe me, when it's your son, your daughter.
My name is Mary Beth Nunnery. I'm a retired lieutenant colonel. I served in the Army Nurse Corps for 23 years, 1971 to 1995. You know, I'm in a position now where I have a 16-year-old son. He won't be sitting safely if the draft is established. And I'll drive him to Canada myself. I don't believe in what's going on. I just think it's all wrong. I think it's unjust. I think it's immoral. I think that when God said, "Thou shalt not kill," I don't think he was kidding around.
I'm James T. Morris, retired United States Army. And I joined the Army and served both in the Korean War and the Vietnamese War in a 22-year military career. When I was in Korea, I felt lost because I really was not from an embattled family. And I also came from a Christian home, which taught thou shalt not kill. It was more than just overcoming fear. It was overcoming a moral picture about what I became as a killer. I still support military action when it's warranted, but for some reason I just can't get my mind around this war that we're dealing with right now.
So as far as war is concerned, I believe it's necessary, but it is the absolute last option to me. I mean, it's when there is no other option.
That audio diary was produced by Kim Green and Hal Humphreys. As the U.S.-Iraqi conflict continues to unfold, a closer look at recent history reveals a familiar U.S. policy goal with origins in the Reagan administration: control of the second largest oil reserves in the world. Post-9/11 reverberations have conveniently brought Iraq into the same broad category of terrorism as al-Qaeda. Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed is a British political scientist and director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in Brighton, England, and the author of The War on Freedom: How and Why America Was Attacked. Pacifica's Peace Watch spoke with him recently as he elaborated on the current crisis in Iraq.
There were plans to invade Afghanistan again long before September 11th. And these were actually reported in the Washington Post, in a Canadian newspaper, the Toronto Star, several other sources as well, which talked about these escalating plans to invade Afghanistan in about starting from the year, by the end of the year 2000, moving through the year 2001. These plans were there and were escalating. We have many reports of Al-Qaeda members and members of the Taliban fled to Pakistan, may have done so with the connivance of the U.S. government. There was one report which I read from the Daily Telegraph here in London. There was a farmer who was on the ground in Afghanistan who witnessed the bombing campaign against the Tora Bora complex. That was when President Bush made the kind of famous statement that we're going to smoke them out. And at that time, gave this analogy that we're farmers, and you know, we, amongst the things that we do, apart from tilling the land, we also look after our sheep. And when we look after our sheep, we always come at them from four sides. And he goes, what I don't understand is why the military only went to the Tora Bora complex from three sides, and they left one side completely open. And the side they left open were particularly the exit routes going to Pakistan. And quite predictably, as the U.S. government was bombing the hell out of the Tora Bora complex, Al-Qaeda fled through the exit routes. Mm-hmm. Which were left open and escaped into Pakistan.
And so that's why you say with perhaps the connivance of the U.S. military?
Yeah, perhaps the connivance.
But what would be the advantage of that?
It all comes down to looking at very convoluted relationship between Al-Qaeda and the United States. I mean, there was one statement by Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Yeah, he came on CNN. One of the journalists asked him, you know, has the war on terrorism really been a success? Because, you know, we can't find Osama bin Laden. That was a key point of this war. And wouldn't you say that since we haven't found him, that it's failed? And then he replied, it's never been about trying to get Osama bin Laden. That really astounded me because it just completely just wiped away what we've been told that the U.S. government has been trying to get Osama bin Laden for so long. And suddenly Myers comes out and says, it's never been about getting him. That's not important. The answer to the question of why would they have this attitude towards Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden is because the war on terrorism as it is now is not so much about fighting terrorism. Once we look at the fact that there were these contingency plans, those plans are actually being followed now to the letter. What is happening now is exactly what has been planned by successive administrations for several years, and it's a plan which has evolved. September 11th provided the opening for these plans to be carried out.
I'm not sure, though, Nafees, I understand why you feel as though the U.S. military may have connived to allow Al-Qaeda to escape.
First of all, let's look at the incident itself. There's two possibilities here. Looking at anything, I mean, without having any biased understanding or anything, at face value, no one would want to believe. People would want to know why the hell would they want to do this. But if we look at the fact itself and then say, okay, let's analyze it and let's see what seems most probable. The U.S. military is not completely and utterly incompetent. If we go back to the history of the Balkans, for example, we find that there may be an answer here. There was a paper written by Ochosidovsky, who's a professor of economics at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He's written one paper called Who is Osama Bin Laden? About the whole history of different connections between Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the United States intelligence agency. He discusses and he quotes many very authoritative sources from the Congress, basically talking about how in the first Bosnian War and in the Kosovo War, the United States quite deliberately facilitated the influx of people connected to Al-Qaeda who were basically under the wing of Osama bin Laden into Bosnia and later on into Kosovo in order to secure and manipulate what was happening on the ground. There was actually an official document done by the Republican Party in criticizing the foreign policy of the Clinton administration. And that document analyzed the whole policy during the Bosnian War. And one of the things they disclosed was that the U.S. Special Forces had actually been facilitating the influx of various Afghan Mujahideen to go into Bosnia and to train various elements of the Bosnian Muslim army. If we do fast forward, a general reason that one would say that the United States government would allow bin Laden to escape or allow Al-Qaeda to continue existing in that manner would essentially be to allow the existence of a pretext to continue to justify the war on terrorism. Because if we have these plans which exist, to go into Iraq, to have a confrontation with China, to go into Iran, to go into Syria, mm-hmm. to establish a presence in North Korea, etc., etc., these plans existed prior to September 11th. And we find that right now there is a drive by the Bush administration to do these things. Mm. Then they have to have a reason, and it would be impossible for them to have done so without having the pretext of fighting against international terrorism. And Al-Qaeda being this indeterminable entity which is not restricted by nation states, it's ever present throughout the world, and there is no quantifiable definition of when it has been destroyed. It allows you to kind of say, okay, we have this permanent threat to the existence of our civilization, and now we have to enter into a state of permanent war.
Mm-hmm. A Washington Post report from January 12th details a top-secret memo from Bush relayed to internal White House staff outlining the plans for the, quote, campaign against terrorism in Afghanistan. In the memo, there was a footnote that also directed the Pentagon to begin planning for the invasion of Iraq, and the Post describes this memo as a further example of the internal decision-making process being obscured from public view. How are Iraq and Afghanistan tied together with the massive oil drilling plans set for South Asia, in your opinion?
Afghanistan is a very strategic region. It provides the gateway to Central Asia. Central Asia is where we have the Caspian Basin, where there's a large amount of untapped oil and gas reserves there. Now, originally, prior to 9/11, U.S. corporations had estimated there to be hundreds and billions of barrels worth of oil and gas in the Caspian Sea. Afghanistan was hoped to provide a place where they could establish pipelines running through Afghanistan, running off the coast of Pakistan, and ending up in the Caspian Sea, mm-hmm. so that they could basically funnel this oil and gas to the United States. So that's one of the obvious issues in relation to the energy issue. Mm-hmm. With respect to Iraq, Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world, and there have been reports by experts speculating that Iraq may actually have the first largest oil reserves, even larger than Saudi Arabia's. We have these two very strategic regions prior to 9/11, and even a few months after 9/11, the Bush administration was convinced were essential in order to establish their control of world energy resources. And I think the urgency of the Bush administration's desire to do that was made all the more urgent because of the energy crisis that was going on. The year 2000 to 2001, world oil production peaked. And what that means is that half your world oil reserves have actually already been depleted. When that happens, then production inevitably declines after that. There's one guy called Colin Campbell, and he has basically written a paper on this. And in these first few years, we haven't felt the brunt. But after about a decade, it's going to become quite bad. And in a few more decades, we'll really actually start to feel the crisis. A whole kind of really doom, gloom, disaster scenario. This was a very key impetus for the Bush administration mm-hmm. in, you know, kind of designing its plans.
Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed is director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in England.
Father, Father, we don't need to ask your name. War is not the answer. Cause only love can pay. You know we gotta find a way to bring some love in here today. Picket lines, picket signs. Don't you punish me.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Matt Bradley, Keith Chalgion, Benta Berkland, Radha Lewis, and Ingrid Drake. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at PacificaArchives.org. or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening. Don't you punish me.